afternoon, everyone. It's good to have our guests here today. Although she does not appear on our calendar today, Clerk of the House Ramona Kennedy will appear before us first today to explain something of benefit to all of us here and especially legislators. Ms. Kennedy, would you come forward, please? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We understand you're here to talk to us about consent calendar, and we would love to know more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name for the record is Ramona Kennedy. I'm Chief Clerk of the House. Members of the committee, on opening day of the session, you approved a new order of business called consent calendar. And basically, what that provides is an opportunity to move measures as you view them in committee, measures which have received a unanimous affirmative vote of the members present. You have the opportunity to place, add the recommendation that be placed on the consent calendar. The consent calendar will be brought up under the orders of business prior to third reading of House bills on the main floor. And the difference between consideration of those measures as compared to other measures on the floor is that there will be no debate and there will be no carrier. The only opportunity you will have while you consider that measure is to provide for a call of the House. There will be a reading of the bill number, the title, and the short summary, and then presiding officer, the Speaker of the House, will ask for immediate vote on that measure. The responsibility of this committee and all committees on the House side, should they choose to use the consent calendar as a recommendation, is to add that to the recommendation to the floor. It can be added to a measure that has no amendments or a measure that has amendments, as long as you have a unanimous affirmative vote in favor of that measure. We've chatted with your committee staff. You have two options. You can combine the motion. You know clearly that this is going to go without dissension and do a recommendation to the floor that it do pass with the amendments or no amendments and that it be placed on the consent calendar. All members of the committee present will have to vote aye. You can separate the motion if you choose to do so, making the first motion to send it to the floor, a second motion to placing it on the consent calendar. The advantage to that is that some may want to vote unanimously for the bill, but maybe they don't feel like it should go on the consent calendar. In either case, I would suggest that if you don't get a unanimous on both, chances are the member who is dissenting will find three friends and file an objection at the desk, and it will be removed from the consent calendar. If something has been filed with your committee for the consent calendar, it will appear on the committee report file, most known by everyone as the blue sheet. It comes out daily, placed on your desks. You need to pay close attention to those measures, not only out of your committee, but out of other committees. Should you have an objection to one of them being placed on the consent calendar, you'll need to come to my office and file your objection. Upon receipt of four objections, it will be removed from the consent calendar and placed in its normal course in the order of business of which it should be scheduled. You have 2 days to file that objection. Otherwise, it will proceed to the consent calendar. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions, sir.
Thank you. Do we have questions? Representative March.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Clerk. You would have 2 days to file after the committee action, is it?
No. The committee, actually, the way this process works is your committee may take action today. Your staff has 3 days to get all the paperwork, the amendments finalized, and the SMS completed, and file it at our desk. You have 2 days after it appears on the blue sheet.
Oh.
That is your notification that I've received it and that I'm holding it at my desk.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir.
Thank you for the questions. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Okay. Just to announce to the committee, we've got a lot of work to do today. We're going to jumble our schedule just a bit here. I do want to draw the committee's attention to the work sessions you see on the schedule, beginning with House Bill 2028 and going through 2034. Not to be alarmed there, we're going to be sending that out to another committee today, so we won't technically be working it in that sense. Also on our schedule today, we are going to move HCR 2 to the front of the schedule. That should be a fairly quick work today. DOC has requested that we move 2097 in front of 2096, and I do think that 2097 will be relatively short work, but that's been said before. Okay, let's move into... pardon me? Yes, let's move into a public hearing on HCR2. And our representative from Portland, please.
Good afternoon.
Hi there. If you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Wilson and members of the committee, let me thank you first for the opportunity to appear before you today regarding House Concurrent Resolution 2. For the record, I'm Judy Tuttle. I'm the Deputy Chief of Staff for Mayor Vera Katz, and I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak before the committee today on this resolution. Mayor Katz has asked me, first of all, to express her regrets she wasn't able to attend this committee meeting this afternoon, and further requested that I pass on her deep appreciation for your quick response in taking up this resolution. We in Portland are excited and we're pleased with the variety of activities we have planned and organized throughout this coming year to recognize the 150th anniversary of the incorporation of our city. However, as we began to plan some of these events, we became aware of the very central role that the State Legislative Assembly had in granting that original charter of incorporation. And the committee working on this project immediately decided that it would be fitting to request the current Legislative Assembly to participate in the recognition of this important date. And so to that end, we have requested adoption of Concurrent Resolution 2 by the 71st Legislative Assembly to mark that. And we're appearing here today to encourage this committee to pass the resolution on for consideration on January 23rd, 2001, which would be the 150th year to the day that the original charter was granted by the then Territorial Legislative Assembly. And so we hope that we can count on you for that.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? All right, seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on HCR 2, and I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
I'd like to move House Concurrent Resolution Number 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner moves HCR 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have any discussion? Any objections? Motion carries. Representative Gardner, would you like to...
I'd be very happy to.
Thank you. All right, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2028, and Representative Devlin, do you have a motion, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2028 to the floor without recommendation, and it would be referred to the School Funding and Tax Fairness Committee and Revenue.
Thank you. Representative Devlin has moved House Bill 2028 to the floor without recommendation, and it be referred to the School Funding and Tax Fairness Committee Revenue. Any discussion? Any objection? Not ordered. All right. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2028. We will open a work session on House Bill 2030. Representative Devlin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill 2030 to the floor without recommendation and that it be referred to the School Funding and Tax Fairness Committee Revenue by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Devlin has moved House Bill 2030 to the floor without recommendation and that it be referred to the School Funding and Tax Fairness Committee Revenue by prior reference. Do we have any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2030, and we'll open the work session on House Bill 2030. Representative Devlin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill 2031 to the floor without recommendation, and it be referred to the School Funding and Tax Fairness Committee Revenue by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Devlin has moved House Bill 2031 to the floor without recommendation, and it be referred to the School Funding and Tax Fairness Committee Revenue by prior reference. Do we have any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2031. Opening the work session on House Bill 2034. Representative Devlin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2034 to the floor without recommendation, then it be referred to the School Funding and Tax Fairness Committee Revenue.
Thank you. Representative Devlin has moved House Bill 2034 to the floor without recommendation, and that it be referred to the School Funding and Tax Fairness Committee Revenue. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman. want to put on record that I've never been a reader before, but it's interesting.
My job, too. Life after terminal. No objections, I'm not sorted. And we'll close the work section on House Bill 2034. Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2097. Let's check our list of here. Scott Taylor, Department of Corrections, please. Good afternoon, Mr. Taylor.
Good afternoon, sir.
And would you identify yourself, please, for the record, and we'll ask you to begin testimony.
Thank you. Chairman Wilson and members of the committee, I'm Scott Taylor, Assistant Director, Correctional Programs, Oregon Department of Corrections. The bill we're here for today, we view as a cleanup bill, basically. We provide information on in support of House Bill 2097, which was introduced at the request of the department. For the past few years, minors convicted of certain crimes have been committed to the adult correction system. The laws establishing the Department of Corrections did not anticipate this process, and as a result, the authority to provide medical and mental health treatment to these minors is not clear. On advice of General Counsel, the Department proposed language to make it clear that the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority have authority to provide medical and mental health treatment to minors sentenced as adults. The Oregon Youth Authority now only has clear authority to provide those treatments to minors sentenced as youth. The specific language proposed was developed by the Attorney General's Office, and this legislation reduces possible state or tort liability in providing medical and mental health to minors incarcerated as adults.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Taylor?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Currently, is the service being provided to these people?
Chair Wilson and Representative Walker, yes, it is. We are providing the service on our interpretation, the best interpretation we have of our authority. This is simply to make it clear that we have the authority to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Taylor? Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, and I think most people already know this, in our normal occurrences, most offenders under 18 until they reach the age of majority are held in an Oregon Youth Authority facility, correct?
Yes.
Thank you for the questions. All right, Mr. Taylor, thank you. And next to testify will be Kathy Osborne, Juvenile Rights Project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Osborne. I'm a senior attorney with the Juvenile Rights Project in Portland. Juvenile Rights Project supports this bill. It is a needed change. Juveniles are receiving currently medical care in DOC and in OIA, but there is not the legal authority for that. It is interesting to note, last February, the Juvenile Rights Project, with the cooperation of the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority, as well as help from the OHSU, did a health study of juveniles under 18 who are currently housed in DOC facilities. And what we found was that these juveniles had significant differences in the medical treatment that they needed than the adults that they're incarcerated with. I know that DOC has been taking efforts to meet those medical needs of the juveniles that they do have within their facilities, and we would like to commend them at this point for working on that and for making sure that the needs of these juveniles are being met. If any of the members of the committee would like a copy of the health study, I can make it available to you. Unfortunately, we thought they were going to be back from the copiers yesterday, and they were not.
Thank you. And if you would make those available, we'd appreciate that very much. Any questions for Ms. Osborne, please? All right, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have anybody else who'd like to testify on this bill who is signed up? Okay, I see none. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2097, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2097. We'll entertain a motion. Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2097 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, and should it move with a unanimous do-pass recommendation, I also move that it's on the consent agenda.
I thank you. Representative Devlin moves House Bill 2097 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and be it noted that if it does pass in a unanimous fashion, Representative Devlin would like to see it added to the consent calendar. Now, we'll split those motions. I think we should do that according to what we heard from the House Clerk. Let's do a roll call, if you will, after any discussion. Okay, seeing no discussion, Clerk, call the roll, please.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Doyle?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Excused.
Representative Merger?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Chair Wilson?
Votes aye. And motion carries. Now, as I understand, we entertain a motion to put it on the consent calendar?
Yes. Okay.
All right, so moved by Representative Devlin. Any discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. All right, close the work session on House Bill 2097. And we'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2096. And Department of Corrections, would you come forward, please? Yourself for the record, please. I would appreciate that. And then take a moment to explain this bill to us.
Chair Wilson, members of the committee, I'm Nick Romanikas from the Oregon Department of Corrections. With me today is Mr. Jeff Van Valkenburg from the Attorney General's Office, Oregon. I'm here today to provide information and support for House Bill 2096, which was introduced at the request of the Department of Corrections. In 1996, the Department of Corrections carried out the first state execution in over three decades by putting Oregon inmate Douglas Wright to death by lethal injection. In preparation for Mr. Wright's execution, the Department adopted a new rule and a comprehensive administrative that established specific procedures for the administration of capital punishment in accordance with Oregon statute, including rules governing the access and conduct of persons invited by the Department to witness execution. Those rules were subsequently upheld in the Oregon Court of Appeals, or were struck down by the Oregon Supreme Court. The specific act that witnesses are permitted to see in 1997 and 1996 did not include the connecting of specific monitoring equipment of the condemned prisoner, placing the prisoner in restraints, and inserting the catheter that later was used to administer lethal drugs. The rule allows for access of the observation by the witnesses while minimizing the exposure of the members of the execution team to witnesses out of concern for staff safety and institution security. Specifically, at the time the department adopted the execution rules, no state permitted witnesses to view the acts leading up to the actual administration of the lethal drugs. To the best of the department's knowledge, this remains the law and practice in every state conducting lethal injections. Challenges filed by the media and organizations were nearly identical to the execution rule adopted by the California Department of Corrections. Our own federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld California's execution rule as constitutional. The department requests statutory authority for the director of the corrections to adopt the rule that establishes the steps in the process for an execution that each witness observes to ensure staff safety and institution security. In conclusion, I just want to say that I have a concern with my 24 years of experience with the Department of Corrections for our staff safety should we not have the authority to move forward with a rule governing executions. We've listened to some of the other states' concerns on this issue, California, Texas. Those who do a lot of executions have a concern for their staff when they're dealing with an individual who have what we call
hierarchy of power inside of a institution setting. Inside of an institution is a little bit different than being in the community. There's a little different of a hierarchy and authority for some particular inmates, and some other inmates may support their causes that would not be very friendly to our staff or their families. So for those reasons, I have a concern that without that authority, we would not be able to protect them as we should as employees for the state. We understand and value the need for the media to cover an execution, and so we're not trying to roadblock their access to this process, but we do have a concern of how this process is carried out.
Thank you.
Chair Wilson, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Van Valkenburg. I'm general counsel to the Department of Corrections in the Department of Justice. I'm here today at the request of the Department of Corrections, not on the request of my agency. The Department of Justice has no position on this bill. I don't have any prepared remarks, but I'm here to answer any questions you may have about the court decisions that affected the validity of the department's prior rules that were struck down by the Oregon Supreme Court. And I'm conversant with both the state Supreme Court opinion and the Ninth Circuit opinion.
Yes, if you could give us some background on that, we'd
sure.
appreciate that.
For obvious reasons, this state had not engaged in an execution in over three decades. The Department of Corrections toured the states that do this, and they learned a lot. And based on that experience, they adopted a very comprehensive set of administrative rules to govern the access of folks who were witnesses to the execution and also to govern their conduct. After the second execution of Harry Moores in 1997, some media organizations in this state challenged the validity of the department's rules. The name of the case was Oregon Newspaper Publishing Association versus Department of Corrections. The rules that were challenged were principally two types. The Department of Corrections had a rule that prohibited witnesses from disclosing after the execution the identity of staff that they might have observed in the process so as to protect their safety and the safety of their families. The other set of rules that the media organizations challenged were the rules that prevented certain steps leading up to the actual administration of the lethal drugs in the execution to be observed by witnesses. And those steps were the strapping down of the condemned inmate on the gurney, the application of the monitoring equipment, and the insertion of the intravenous catheter that would be used for ultimately for the introduction of the death-causing drugs. At the same time, the Department of Corrections in California, with nearly identical procedures, was defending a lawsuit brought in the federal court down there. Ultimately, the Ninth Circuit upheld the Department of Corrections rules in California against a similar challenge by media organizations under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. The litigation in Oregon, as it went up through the Intermediate Court of Appeals and then on to the Oregon Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals upheld the Department of Corrections rules. The Oregon Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals and held that those two areas of the rules were not expressly authorized in the statute that set out the process for execution in the state, and the court would not infer it. They would not infer that authority.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason the Department of Corrections is here before you today is to ask for express statutory authority to reinstate those rules that govern the access of witnesses to observe certain steps in the process to protect the safety and security of staff and their families. You know, as they have discussed with you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to ask, in this process, the details of DOC's concern about identification of people involved in the process. First of all, we have two different kinds of identification, as I see it here. Identification by actual witnesses who are there, and then perhaps the ancillary identification by media coverage. Are you talking about cameras? Are you concerned about cameras witnessing the prior events to execution here, the steps as they're called in the bill prior to? Are you concerned about the cameras grinding away when those things are happening?
We're concerned about cameras and the witnesses viewing that
part of the process.
Could I ask why you're concerned about the witnesses viewing that? I know you're saying the identification of the DOC personnel. Carry that a little farther.
Why don't you explain a little bit about what staff are viewable under those procedures? Who's there?
And it would be the execution team, which is assembled to get the inmate prepared for the execution itself. And that execution team within the Department of Corrections are volunteers from that particular institution that move through that process. It, again, as I stated, if the inmate is very much in, a person who's in favor, following good favors for the inmate population, then there's a lot of inmate support in the general population and in the community for him or her, whoever it may be. And that concerns would be if the individual did not want to be carried out with the execution, didn't feel like that he wanted to participate or she did not want to participate, and things be was uncooperative, and there had to be other measures put into place to ensure that those, that execution could be carried out. At that point, those individuals who would be involved in that process would be looked at as the execution squad. Again, that would make their job difficult when they went back to their normal jobs. I mean, that isn't the only job they would have, would be the execution. And it would make it difficult not only in their job within the state employment, but also could possibly carry over into the community if there was gang ties or other support groups for them in the communities.
Are you concerned about what effect that it would have on the jail populace if they do have access to television, if they were watching one of their own, so to speak, going to execution in a non-compliant fashion?
Chair, that is one of my concerns, and again, it would be a carryover from that particular setting into the general population and the community, because they do have visitors that come visit them, and they also have connections out into the community.
Mm-hmm. Questions from the committee. Representative Garai.
I'm curious. You said that the people who involve themselves in the pre-execution process are volunteers. Am I correct?
Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Are these people instructed as to or given caution about the fact that the media could be present and that the media's present could result in some kind of post-execution publicity?
Chair, Representative Girard, that is correct. But as we had the rules set forth in the two executions, they were moving forward with the understanding that witnessed events were limited to just the execution itself. It wasn't the entire execution. We did not have to face that at this point as far as a full disclosure of the event of the execution.
Further questions? Representative Devlin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First question is that it's a way of background. In the last session, I think, and in probably the final weeks of the session, we heard a death penalty related bill actually again in this committee. The bill did not pass out of committee, but at that time it dealt with a different issue, and they went through what basically is the history of the death penalty since it's been put back in place and what the situation was relative to the appeal status of inmates that were on death row at this time. And from that testimony, it was unclear whether or not we were in an imminent situation where someone might face the death penalty in the future, because it did appear that those people that would avail themselves of all of the potential appeals, it might be some time until they face that ultimate sanction, and that for those people that waive their appeals might see that sanction sooner. Do we have any projection on when we will have to face this process again?
Chair Wilson, Vice Chair Devlin.
Lead in, but
yes, there's a long process for inmates convicted in this state of aggravated murder who are awaiting ultimate execution on death row if they want to pursue all the appeals that are available to them. However, as we've seen with Timothy McVeigh and others, and with the two executions that did take place in the state in 96 and in 97, An inmate can decide at any time to forego those appeals, inform the court, and the clock will start kicking once that occurs. So at any time, the Department of Corrections could be facing in any given year the necessity of executing the laws of the state and carrying out capital punishment. So the needs are present for the department to have the ability and the authority from their policy perspective for this bill.
Mr. Chairman,
follow up.
The concern about disclosure is a very legitimate concern concerning the employees. Elsewhere in statute, or is it necessary in statute, are these employees' names exempted from disclosure? I mean, is it normal public records issues?
Let me speak to that as well, Chair Wilson, Vice Chair Devlin. Thank goodness the Department of Corrections in this state has a very broad exemption under the public records law for its documents. And that exemption is essentially that records of the department, which if disclosed would prevent or seriously prejudice the functioning of the department or the rehabilitation of a person in custody of the department, are exempt unless there's some overriding public interest. I can tell you from experience with this, direct experience, that we received many media requests, the Department of Corrections did, about the name of the executioner in the two executions. And to avoid any potential of a legal issue involved in that, the department created no record of the identification of the executioner, so we wouldn't face it. There are some good, good articulable bases under the existing law to keep out the names of staff who would be involved in the execution for some of the reasons that Assistant Director Armenicus has described, their safety, the safety of their families. But I don't know what you're thinking, but if you're thinking that you might want to add something that provides even greater authority, you can talk to the department about it.
Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
Yeah. There's, in terms of the sort of small explanation that was given of the bill by the Department of Corrections, there's a statement in there relative to the bill statute silent regarding media, families of victims, government officials, and other potential monitors. In reading the statute, it does not appear permissive, although perhaps that's within the purview of other statutes in the department. And I know that the rule that they promulgated does allow those people to witness that portion of the actual execution. Are you comfortable that the statute is permissive enough so that I'm in favor of all of those parties being able to view the execution, but that the statute grants you that latitude?
Yes. Chair Wilson, Vice Chair Devlin, what my clients in the Department of Corrections have explained to me is that they are very concerned and would obviously want media representatives to always be present at an Oregon execution. No one could conceive of that not happening. The same is true for, they want crime victims there, they want other groups there. I have advised them that I believe they have general, broad, plenary statutory authority under their creation statutes to determine who has access to the correctional facilities and who does not. So I'm not concerned. We don't need new legislation for the department to be able to invite folks who aren't specifically mentioned in the statute to be present, if that's your question.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, final question at this time. Relative to the issue of cameras, I haven't actually had time to read the rule that was thrown out by the court. So in terms of being allowed to view the execution, have the courts ruled that that would include recording devices? I mean, do you normally permit recording devices, whether it's...
Chair Wilson, Vice Chair Devlin, I'm not exactly sure what the rule says. What I know by experience, and Assistant Director Armenicus, you correct me if I'm wrong, the fact of the matter is that cameras almost never go into a prison, and I'm sure that they were not allowed for the executions. I do not believe, but I'm not sure, that if there was a rule that prohibited that, I don't know that that was challenged by the media in the lawsuit. That wasn't the principal focus. The principal focus were two things. The nondisclosure of the identity of staff, if they were observed, and the steps, viewing the steps. It didn't focus on cameras and those sort of things. But the federal constitutional law on that is that the media has no greater right in a prison than does the public.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Walker.
The individuals that, Mr. Armenicus, the individuals that carry out the execution, are they the employees of the institution? They have regular employment duties at the institution on a daily basis, or are they outside of the institution? You bring in individuals from outside?
Chair, Representative Walker, those are employees that have current everyday jobs with inside that facility.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
I have a question, and maybe you can clarify this for me. It said the department requests a statutory authority for the Director of Corrections to adopt rules, et cetera, et cetera. Is it safe to say that these rules would be the same rules as there are in the paragraph above? In other words, it would only eliminate that part prior to the execution, the strapping down, the catheter injection part of it. In other words, is this open-ended? Could all new rules be drawn by this?
You want to speak to that?
Yeah. Chair Wilson, Representative, is it Berger?
Berger.
Berger. Thank you. The way the bill is drafted now, the legal effect of the language is that it is open-ended. It says the department's director has authority to adopt rules to determine the steps of the process that witnesses may observe. My clients have advised me that their intention is merely to go back to the prior rules at this time under this director of the Department of Corrections. The reason that it's open-ended is because they recognize that there will be successor directors of the Department of Corrections. They may have a different policy, and so it was with that intent that they left it open-ended.
Thank you. I wanted to go back to the accountability issue. Who observes the execution team and the various steps that they go through from the public from an accountability standpoint? Would it only be DOC people? I mean, is this a closed situation where only people on the inside witness the steps up to what the public can see? Or at present time, is anyone from the quote-unquote outside world able to watch the steps prior to that point?
Chair, currently it would be just the DOC staff, assistant directors and directors that would be present to ensure that that process was carried out in a humane manner.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Further questions?
Chair Wilson, if I might. You had a question about, or actually Vice Chair Devlin did, about what the rules provided. The rules provided at the time, they are currently the rules. Notepads, pens, or pencils issued by the penitentiary to approve witnesses and media representatives will be the only items or equipment permitted inside the secure perimeter of the penitentiary. So cameras were not allowed.
Thank you. If no further questions, we will thank you. And
thank you.
On your way. Appreciate that. Next up will be Arwin Byrd, please. If you would identify yourself, please.
Certainly. Good afternoon, Chair Wilson, members of the committee. I am here representing survivors advocating for an effective system. We are an organization of survivors of crime and their friends. Some of our members have survived the murder of a loved one. I am here in opposition to this bill, 2096. We fundamentally oppose the ability of government to restrict our access. The citizens of Oregon have voted to empower their government to execute people convicted of aggravated murder. The citizens of Oregon, through the media and we as survivors, should be able to observe this process. As survivors, we are currently given the right to witness executions, and I encourage you not to vote to impinge on that right. Those are my statements. I didn't prepare anything, so I don't have anything to hand you, but that's essentially my position and the position of our organization on this bill. I'll entertain any questions.
Yes, I would ask you one, and that is, as far as access by the public to this, access, public media, so forth, are you advocating for all of the aforementioned individuals to be able to see all the steps in the process?
Correct, correct. I believe in the transparency of government. You know, we as survivors, although we currently are able to attend executions, We do not believe that the government should, or the Department of Corrections should be able to limit what steps we're able to view. Certainly, a survivor is able to choose whether or not they want to attend the execution, but should they choose to attend, they should be able to see all of the execution.
Great. Thank you. Questions? All right. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Next up will be Andrea Meyer, ACLU, please. Good afternoon.
For the record, I'm Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I very much appreciate having the opportunity to testify before you today. The ACLU of Oregon opposes House Bill 2096. This bill has been introduced at the request of the Department of Corrections in order to overturn a decision by the Oregon Supreme Court in a case brought by the ACLU of Oregon on behalf of the Oregon Newspapers Publishers Association, the Oregonian, the Associated Press, the Statesman Journal, the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, and the Society of Professional Journalists. That decision only covered specific portions of the administrative rules and did not invalidate all of the administrative rules. I want to emphasize that while the ACLU has a long-standing policy in opposition to the death penalty, that is not why we agreed to bring that lawsuit. Indeed, at least one of the news media plaintiffs in that case has editorialized in favor of the death penalty. Rather, at stake in the case and at stake in this bill is an important question of the public's right to know. The public should be able to know how the government carries out its most awesome power, taking the life of a condemned prisoner. Prior to the first execution under the current death penalty statute, the Department of Corrections had promulgated rules for the first time in Oregon history that prevented witnesses to an execution from viewing the entire execution. Those rules prevented witnesses from seeing the condemned prisoner entering the execution chamber, the prisoner being placed in the execution gurney, the connection of special monitoring equipment, placing the prisoner in restraints, and inserting the intravenous catheter that is used to administer the fatal drugs. Instead, witnesses were only allowed to witness the final part of that execution when the lethal dose was injected from a separate room out of the view of the witnesses. Never before in Oregon had officials attempted to carry out any part of the execution process out of view of public representatives. Originally, from territorial days through the early 1900s, executions took place in full public view. For example, in the 1902 at 5th and Salmon in downtown Portland, 400 persons witnessed the hanging of two men as they were marched from county jail to the scaffold. Prayers were spoken, the nooses were adjusted, and the men were dropped to their deaths. Later, when executions were moved behind the walls of the Oregon State Penitentiary, only invited witnesses were allowed, but among those invited have always been a pool of reporters in order to represent the public at large. In 1939, in Oregon's newly created gas chamber, news media representatives and other witnesses watched Leroy McCarthy enter the gas chamber, be strapped to the steel chair, and then die as deadly cyanide was released from underneath the chair. It is well understood by all present at those executions that the execution consisted of more than the final few seconds prior to death. Thus, it should have been of little surprise to the department officials when the Oregon Supreme Court held that the department rules that barred witnesses from seeing the entire execution violated ORS 137-473. The court held that the language in the statute is clear, and the requirement that witnesses be present at the execution is a process of putting a prisoner to death, including all acts inextricably linked, with the administration of fatal drugs. As such, the agency exceeded its statutory authority by impairing the right granted to witnesses by ORS 137.473 to view the execution. And I may note that that statute came about because the voters of Oregon reenacted the death penalty and stated witnesses should be present at the execution. While the ACLU had raised additional constitutional arguments in this court case against the department's rules, the court didn't yet address those arguments, finding that first the rules violated the statute and held according at that point. Now the department comes to you seeking the authority to rewrite the definition of an execution, not in the statute, but by administrative rule. Obviously, the power they seek is once again to place them that most of the execution process behind a veil of secrecy. To give the department the power to rewrite the statute would be bad policy. To do so, to allow an execution, the ultimate and most awesome use of governmental power, to take place almost entirely in secret is even worse. Witnesses should be able to observe the execution process from beginning to end. To be present at an execution means what it says, to observe the execution. It should not mean being placed in a room behind a curtain that is only open after the condemned inmate has been brought into the room and strapped down, had a heart monitor and intravenous catheters inserted, and then administered a sedative. Those acts are essential parts of the execution. Such censorship of the process is counter to our history and will lead us down the path towards more government secrecy. It is critically important for an open and free society to resist using the excuse of administrative convenience to justify such secrecy. In the past, the Department of Corrections has argued that censoring the view of the execution process is necessary to ensure the safety of corrections officials who are carrying out the execution. Such safety concerns can be ensured by less sweeping methods other than limiting access to the process for those correction officers who participate in this process, and it is voluntary. In the administrative rules, it notes that, and there's a conscientious clause as well for anyone who doesn't want to participate in that. For those correction officers who do participate in this process and want to maintain their anonymity, they could wear surgical masks and other clothing to hide their identity. The director can provide, under current administrative rules, such protections and is authorized under current law to do that. This bill is not necessary to solve that problem. Finally, as I noted above, the Oregon Supreme Court did not address the constitutionality of limiting witness access to important portions of the execution process. We continue to believe that if the court is required to address that question, it holds that the type of rules limiting access to the that the department would promulgate under the authority it seeks here would violate the Oregon Constitution. We strongly urge this committee to reject House Bill 2096, and in doing so, that you endorse the important principle of open government and the public's right to know. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Berger, please.
I think that I understand your argument is more the principle of the thing. Is that what I'm following?
Chair Wilson, Representative Berger. Thank you. I'm sorry. Haven't had a chance to meet you yet. The principle of the public's right to know is what we support.
Okay. Because you don't feel that the public doesn't understand what is going to happen in a death penalty. I mean, we have it on television over and over in crime scenes. So it's the public's right to know of this particular incident?
Chair Wilson, Representative Berger. It's both. I think it is the public's. You indicated that television executions. I'm not sure of execute. I've never seen an execution unless it's television fiction.
Right.
Certainly in Oregon, there's never been televising of the death penalty. It is both for the public to know and understand, and to make sure that when the most awesome power of the government is used, that it is administered knowingly and correctly and in the most humane way. And that there are witnesses from the media who can tell us as a society that those laws and that decision is being carried out properly.
I'd like to follow up, please. I'd like to address your remark about the awesome power of government, because I do believe that the people who are carrying out what the people voted for is a very difficult task for those people who have to carry this out. So I think that to say it's the awesome power of government, it might be the awesome power of the people. They did determine that that was legal. Otherwise, these people are left with having to carry that out.
Chair Wilson, Representative Verger, if I think I understand what you're saying, yes, the Austin Powers both with the state, and yes, the issue of those who actually, the corrections officers who carry out the duty, is that what you were speaking to there?
Surely. They were given, they're not the awesome power of government.
Right.
They are paid, you know, they are employed to do a job which the people have legally voted that
right.
they do. I just want to,
right.
you know, those of us in government are a little sensitive to being said. Many times we carry out the wishes that come from the
right.
ballot box.
And I believe that what is the issue here is, again, carrying out the will of the voters in the ballot box, because the statute at issue, which they seek to amend, speaks to witnesses being present at the execution.
Sure.
That's there, and that was the will of the people. And what the court said in its decision was execution means what it says. It doesn't mean the final little portion of the execution, but the execution process at the end. And the court spoke to the fact that, no, this does not mean the last meal and what goes on before. It has to be closely related to the final act of execution. And certainly we believe that bringing someone in, strapping them down, putting on a heart monitor, putting in the catheter, giving them a sedative, and engaging in that is the execution. The final dose, once through that catheter, is the completion of the execution. But we believe that the statute was clear that the people asked that witnesses be able to attend the execution. And the media should likewise be able to then see, as well as the witnesses of the crime victim families and others, the execution. And it should not be done mostly behind the secrecy of a drape.
Ms. Meyer, a couple of questions. One would be about the number of states in the union that allow full disclosure from the beginning of the execution process to the conclusion. How many, to your knowledge, currently do this?
Chair Wilson, I apologize. I do not know and have not researched the area of what other states do. I only can speak to Oregon and its past.
One safety-related question I want to ask you. If there is full disclosure, do you have fear of what that could incite within a prison itself? If the folks incarcerated there were actually able to see everything going on from beginning to end and say it went badly,
well,
do you have any concern about the personal safety of the inmates inside the prison?
Chair Wilson, I'm not sure I understand your question. So let me
rephrase that then. If there is full disclosure to the media, and the individuals inside the facility can see what is going on in their own death house, and perhaps it doesn't go well, do you have any concern not only for the welfare of the guards in that institution, but the prisoners who may be caught in the bite of the line, so to speak, inside that?
Chair Wilson, I'm going to make an assumption that as part of your question, there is it's being televised. It sounded to me as if people could see it.
Television, yes, but also live microphones as well.
Currently, Chair Wilson, currently the administrative rules, interestingly enough, that allow the media to be there. And the same rules can and do limit the ways of which the media reports it, I believe. I mean, we have no position on it being televised, but so far, I believe the rules speak to three or four pool reporters being present. I don't think there's any. I'll let the media address whether they seek to have microphones present, but certainly it seems to be the authority within the rules to deal with that. And they currently have the authority to promulgate those rules as long as they're consistent with not being prior restraint, which was the other portion of the court decision.
Thank you for the questions. All right, thank you.
I'm sorry.
Representative Walker.
The individuals that carry out an execution, have there been any reports or studies done on those individuals after an execution as to whether they have been followed, monitored, questioned, interviewed, whatever, after an execution as to how they feel about it or how they responded to such scrutiny?
Chair Wilson, Representative Walker, I do not know whether there have been studies. I missed most of the portion of National Public Radio's recent story on this issue, and I think actually interviewing those folks. To the degree that there's concern, first of all, there will always be corrections officers who are engaging in the process of the execution as long as there are executions. And the emotional, physical, and potentially deep impact on their lives will exist as long as we engage in executions. But I'm not sure that's the issue here, because we are not focused on the identity and not allowing them to provide safety means, as my testimony spoke to protect their identity, to wear a surgical mask or otherwise to not be readily identified during the process. I don't think the media has been very, I understand there were some questions as to who was the executioner, and I understand from previous testimony that there is a way to avoid disclosing that without running afoul to the law. What we're concerned about is witnessing the execution and the right to know and see that, and not to cause any distress or pain to the corrections officer. But there are rules that they can do to ensure that without amending the statute and taking away authority from the legislature and giving it to themselves.
All right. Thank you. Representative Doyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Meyer, I guess I'm just a little confused. Are you saying that your position is that an individual or an employee's identity is not part of, full disclosure of the execution process?
Chair Wilson, Representative Doyle, I will let the media more closely address what their needs are in terms of that. I will say that to the safety and issue of the identity within the room, the need for a corrections officer to wear safety protective manner so as to not disclose their face, their identity in that room at that time. That's the issue I'm focused on, and that's the issue that we do not oppose. They're taking steps. In terms of what the public record is and the access to Department of Corrections information, I'm not familiar with what is currently accessible in those records as to who was there and who was engaged in various parts of the process.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Garage.
Thank you. Just one quick question. Are the volunteers who participate in the process compensated in any way?
Chair Wilson, Representative Girard.
Yes.
By volunteer, you mean the corrections officers? I'm afraid I'm not familiar with the process and Department of Corrections folks could address. I know from administrative rules, they've already got rules that are still valid about conscientious clause, and no one wants to participate, and I don't know what other compensation they provide.
All right, no more questions. Thank you very much.
I appreciate
your testimony. Next to testify will be Brian DeLashmet. And I do believe that Brian represents corrections folks.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeLashmet, representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. Those are the employees at the Oregon State Penitentiary and several other facilities, but they are the employees that we've been talking about today. Let me give you a couple of more general comments and concerns, and then get to kind of a couple of the issues that have been brought up today and on the policy issues. The first thing I would, any of you who have not gone out to the state penitentiary, I would welcome you to go out there. And what I would hope you would draw away from that visit is that you are talking about a population that's behind closed walls. The interchange and the area and the space between the inmates and the employees is limited. There is not an avenue, if there's a threat by inmates against correctional employees, for the employees to just basically get away. So the threat that we're talking about as far as potential retaliation that would occur behind those walls is in fact a threat that our folks take very seriously. The second thing that I want to let you know is in the execution teams, we are talking about correctional employees, but potentially some other healthcare workers, whether it's a doctor or a nurse. So we're not talking specifically about this big, strapping, 6'5" gentleman that's on the execution team that thinks this is really macho and this is what they want to do and that's why they're volunteering. These are workers that are dedicated to their job. They volunteered because the citizens of the state of Oregon have said this is what they would like to have occur. The courts have found this person not only guilty, but a jury has sentenced them. And these folks in the line of their duty are taking part in the process to and make sure that that, in fact, occurs. Now, specifically to a couple of things that have been brought up, the previous speaker talked about the anonymity of the employees if the process was much broader than just the final stages. Without having a correctional officer here, I'm going off my knowledge base and talking to them about the dangers that go on behind those facilities. But the previous speaker specifically talked about the ability for somebody just to wear a surgical mask. Well, we could go back to the executioner wearing a black hood. We're not talking about people in the dark of night lynching somebody. We are talking about a legal execution here. But as far as the safety issue of the simplistic view that you could use a surgical mask to hide your identity, one is I am not convinced that that hides the entire identity, whether it's by video, whether it's by a microphone in which a voice identification could occur, or whether it's by the description of a reporter who, in fact, does identify indirectly those employees that were participating in that process. By some physical description of those that participated, for example, the 6'5" or the rather rotund 5'8" employee that inserted the catheter. So we have concerns besides just the issue of the live video broadcast or the mic. The one other thing that I'd like to focus on as far as the surgical mask. Simplistic solution is that when someone is going down the path to execution, they do not always go willingly, and there are struggles that occur. And what you're asking an employee to do is volunteer and then jeopardize their safety by putting something over their face, around their neck, or being tied behind their head, in which that could be used as a weapon against them. For example, in the case of the surgical mask, I could immediately assume that somehow that surgical mask could be pulled down, could be pulled tight around that employee's neck and be used against that employee. So I guess I would just conclude my comments. We are very concerned about the issue of the safety of the employees themselves. I am not interested in getting the broader discussion of the people's right to know and so forth. I'm here only to portray to you the concern that my employees have about their safety and the ability for friends, families, and associates inside and outside of those institutions to somehow be able to identify them and somehow retaliate against them or their families. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. For the questions, Representative Garrard.
I'm coming back to the fact that these folks are volunteering. Are they not made aware before they volunteer of the safety factors involved?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, under the previous rules that were, in fact, flipped on their ear, they did not have these safety concerns because they weren't identified. So there was no need to have something covering their face or anything else. But I'm glad you brought the issue up of the volunteer issue. I can't speak for all of the employees at the state penitentiary and whether they would or wouldn't volunteer under a totally everybody see kind of a scenario. But I would be very doubtful if you would get volunteers that in fact would participate in that process, either for the idea that they may be identified and therefore there's some safety risk, or if they had to go through and somehow mask themselves by using surgical masks or whatever, and they would consider that a safety risk and perhaps not volunteer in those circumstances. But directly to your question, prior to this, they didn't have that concern because the issue wasn't that they could be identified. They, in fact, did have that veil.
Thank you for the questions.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate that. Now, representative of the Corvallis Gazette Times, please. And would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Sure. My name is Rob Pride, and I'm the managing editor down at the Gazette Times, and I thank you for hearing this issue today. I have a short statement. I've got a couple of copies I can pass around. Almost 2 years ago, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that the State Department of Correction cannot restrain witnesses to an execution from discussing what they observe with others. More important, the court determined that the department cannot prevent witnesses to an execution from observing the procedures by which a condemned inmate is prepared for the administration of the fatal drug. Now the corrections department is seeking the legislature's permission to do what the court would not allow 2 years ago. Unfortunately, the department is going even further than its original plan with the introduction of House Bill 2096, which seeks a vaguely worded, open-ended state law that would allow the director to place any restrictions he desires on the witnessing of executions. This simply is unacceptable to the people of Oregon. These restrictions are being justified as a way to protect the anonymity as well as the safety of staff and other people involved in carrying out the death penalty. However, the Corrections Department has failed to cite any specific evidence supporting a need for these restrictions to meet these concerns. The department previously tried to impose rules that prevented witnesses, both the news media and others, from seeing an inmate being strapped into a chair hooked up to the intravenous tubes that deliver the lethal injection. No one wants to see accounts of executions fall into tawdry tabloid-style reports, but there is a strong public interest in getting complete, accurate reports, which this newly proposed legislation would prevent. It's relevant to remember that problems have occurred in other states. Witnesses to the proceedings is a safeguard against missteps that can turn an execution into a final episode of unconstitutional torture of the condemned inmate. Officials fear retaliation by friends or other inmates if it becomes known who carried out the death sentence. The reality is that witnesses are unlikely to pay much attention to or reveal who carries out an execution, but they should be able to if there's misconduct. There's no objection if somebody involved in the process wants to conceal his identity. The public needs to be confident that it is honestly informed about how Oregon carries out its ultimate penalty, and this proposed legislation just does not further that goal. I'd be glad to answer any questions
you have. Thank you for the questions. Representative Doyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pribe, I'm curious, you made a comment saying that there is a need for a complete, accurate report of an execution. Can you describe for me, I mean, an ideal situation from your perspective, what would be a complete, accurate report of an execution?
Well, first of all, I don't have an objection currently to the exemption to the open records law that doesn't disclose the names of who's on the execution team. I don't have a problem with that. And I think what would be complete to my point of view would probably just be the events that lead up to the execution, you know, in those moments before when the inmate is led into a room and then, you know, the devices are applied and then the execution occurs. And to me, that would be satisfactory.
Follow up. I think in prior testimony we had heard that things like being able to witness a last meal or the events of the whole day, for instance, of that individual being executed, that wouldn't be part of a complete report to you.
Not to my mind. I don't think it's practical, frankly.
And then, I'm sorry, follow-up.
Follow-up.
In your opinion, why is the bright line at the point of, you know, those procedures that you had mentioned right prior to the insertion the injection. Why is that a complete accurate report?
I think to me, because it represents kind of the carrying out of the will of the people to execute this person.
Another question, if I may.
Follow up.
On a different note, I guess, the press certainly has certain obligations in reporting issues. Would you see that just, you know, as your own editorial decision, and you view, say, the additional additional procedures that you had mentioned, do you feel then you have an obligation to report on all of those?
Not necessarily. Just let me say one thing, that in my testimony, I'm in no way representing all media in Oregon. And when I consider stories for the Gazette Times, I try to gauge what my readers' interests are and basically what do they want to read over breakfast. And a lot of those things I don't think are appropriate for our paper.
Thank you. Representative Berger, did you have a question?
Yes, and you may have answered this question, but I want to be sure I understand it. Do you agree with the former speaker that it should be the entire process, then that equates to an execution, or do you believe if you see the last half, I know this is just semantics, but if you see just the injection, that also is an execution? Which?
I'm not sure if when you say, you know, all the process, if you're talking like Representative Doyle, if that includes the last meal and meeting with a
minister. No, I'm just talking about the strapping down from that.
Yeah, that's what I'm speaking about. It's just that, you know, sort of leading into the room where the event occurs from beginning to end.
Thank you, Representative Walker.
Yes, you made the comment that you want to complete and accurate reporting. You don't want any tawdry reports or misrepresentation or misreporting.
That's my hope. I'm not saying I can
hope. Right. Well, that's getting to the point of it. Those of us that have been in public life for a number of years and have been in unpopular positions at time and taken unpopular stances and had to do unpopular things, we come under scrutiny of these individual papers who, appear by all appearances, don't ascribe perhaps to the same ethic that you do. And if this is going to go out over all these broadcast reportings, whether there's pictures or not, those media will pick the stories up, and particularly if they are opposed to death penalty, can be an excruciating endurance for some people, because identities can be discovered in many, many ways, regardless of how you try to conceal that identity. If these people are Department of Corrections employees, there will be some way that will be found out. So I think that what I'm asking here is that how do you think that we could ever guard against these tawdry reports or these other papers from not making this their lead story for several months afterwards to perpetuate their point of view?
I think if an execution happens in Oregon, it's going to be the lead story no matter what you do or don't do, because it's rare and it's news. Currently, I don't have any problem with the restrictions that are imposed, that there are no pictures, there are no microphones, and I think that's appropriate at this time. Again, I don't speak for my colleagues in the broadcast media who may have an altogether different viewpoint. I don't think that we can legislate by the irresponsibility of other people. I think we have to legislate from a perspective of what are the very real dangers and what do we want to accomplish here. And I just think that these rules just go too far to the other extreme in trying to legislate something that I don't know it's been demonstrated that it could or would happen.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
You made the comment that we can't legislate against irresponsible conduct and we have to look at the very real dangers. The very real dangers I'm considering and think we need to look at, too, is the very real dangers of those people who carry out the will of the voters.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a good place to be in when you're on the receiving end of those groups that don't agree with what happened. It's a very real danger, and oftentimes their lives are threatened, their children are harassed, their property is harmed, And I think that, to me, a very real danger, we need to look at that as well, because there are a lot of safeguards in the prison system in carrying out executions to make sure those violations don't occur.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a real hard time, you know, looking at how you're weighing the very real danger of something that has so many safeguards in place, that's gone through the court system, that's gone through the correction system, all these things, when you're looking at a person who probably is carrying out the will of the people but wishes to have a certain amount of anonymity in doing it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's hear from the people who have the microphones. That would be interesting to have right now. I'd like to have coming forward Dave Fiskum and Bill Johnstone, representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Speaking of the microphone, I'll use this one. For the record, my name is Dave Fiskum. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, an association of nearly 300 radio and television outlets around this state. With me to my right is Bill Johnstone, the executive director of that association. We would like to make just a few remarks to you. At first blush, House Bill 2096, to those of us who read it a few days ago, seemed like, in one sense, a routine housekeeping bill. It simply gave the department authority to promulgate rules. But I think, as you've seen by testimony presented to this point and by further testimony today, it's far from a routine proceeding, and we want to make you understand a little bit, or without being redundant, about what's at stake beneath the surface. If the department needs rulemaking authority, and I think that is a question you ought to ask in light of what you've already heard, whether the department really needs additional rulemaking authority, we want to make sure that there is no intent to bar the media, including both broadcast and print outlets, from being official observers at executions. We have been heartened to a degree in recent hours by the department's contentions to us in hallway conversations in the building that is not the intent. The very fact that this bill is up for consideration, however, raises the question Representative Devlin raised in earlier questions relative to whether media, family, friends, the appropriate categories need to be in law relative to their participation in this, and not just, as important as a rule is, but not just in rule. We think there's a role for the media to play in this. There are some very tough issues you've heard raised today that will be resolved in some point on the balance between the public's right to know and personal privacy. We don't have the magic answer to that, but to the extent that you as a committee would like to proceed with legislation like this, we'd like to be part of the exercise of trying to improve it if that's possible, even though we may end up in disagreement unilaterally with the department on some issues of the sort that have been described to you. Without making any further opening comments, I'd like to turn, Mr. Chair, with your permission, to Bill, and he may have some things to add based on his experience in this issue over the years.
Thank you.
Chairman Wilson, members of the committee, re-identify myself, Bill Johnstone, President and CEO of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. It's important, and first of all, I do not have any prepared comments. It's important to the media that we be present at the executions as they happen. Representative Berger, all due respect, this is the ultimate power of the government and the people that put those people into office when they would execute a human life. We're the citizens' ears, and we are their eyes. There is no way for the masses in the state of Oregon to know what goes on behind the glass in an execution chamber without those witnesses being there, those media witnesses being there. As right now, there are five media witnesses. The AP has one representative, the newspapers has two representatives, and the Oregon Association of Broadcasters has two representatives, one from television and one from radio. Specifically, we've worked this arrangement out with the department, which is embedded in the current Oregon Administrative Rules 291-024-005 through 291-024-0090. On a side note, I never could understand how you people can keep all those things straight. I commend you.
We don't.
We've worked hard in 1997 to work with the department to put this understanding and to craft these the roles for the media. And we believe that they should be specifically included in the new rule that the department would write under the new authority under House Bill 2096, should it pass. In September 6th of 96, Douglas Wright was put to death. May 16th of 97, Harry Moore was put to death. In those particular executions, the rules of the five media representatives was in place and was carried out without incident. There are no cameras allowed. There are no microphones allowed. There's a pad of paper and either a pencil or perhaps a pen that each reporter is given. They witness the portion of the execution that they have been allowed to witness. They then form outside of the viewing area into a pool area where they then are the eyes and ears to the remainder of the media that may have gathered at that point. At that time, cameras and microphones are permissible to talk with and to record the comments of those pool announcers or those pool reporters, as it would be. If nothing else, the one thing of 2096 that is alarming is, in fact, the open-ended wording. That is our concern, that we have been assured that the department has no cause, this administration has no cause to want to change the rules of the media representatives. But with the wording as it is worded in this bill, that does not say that future administrators may not change their minds and want something a little bit differently. Again, my closing comment, and I would be happy to answer any questions if I can, is that we want to keep it the way it is right now. We would, in fact, like to see, if it were possible, we would like to see the entire execution. In my opinion and the opinion of the broadcasters, the entire execution is, in fact, the entire execution. An eight-course dinner is not the steak, the salad, and the dessert. It also probably would include a glass of wine or a cordial and perhaps an appetizer or something else. It is the entire picture, and I believe that the people of Oregon have a right to the entire picture. If there was a way to deter that type of crime or that type of incident that individual may have been convicted of and being executed for, it would be an opportunity to explain the entire final ultimate act of their death. And so with that would be the end of my comments.
Thank you. Question, Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fiskum and Mr. Johnstone, your unappetizing equation of executions and a mini-course dinner aside, do you think there is room to work together with the department on language that would become more satisfactory to your organization?
Chair Wilson, Representative March, I'm tempted to answer your question yes and no. I think there are aspects of the issues we've talked about today and that may be talked about by our colleagues from the print media in a moment that I think could be worked out in a collaborative fashion where your chair or this committee or some other official to direct us to do so. And I think that would be a useful effort, by the way. It may be that some issues dealing with that balance between the public's right to know and the media's involvement in that and personal privacy could never be resolved by those parties. But I think, in my judgment, the effort is worth it. We tend to have knowledge of, awareness of, confidence in Director Cook and his staff, and I think Mr. Johnstone has hit the nail on the head that this is an issue that could go beyond that, beyond this administration, and I think there is something that can be done to improve the bill before you as well as to verify that the administrative rules are not going to be changed in certain ways to retreat from the agreements we reached in 1997. Long answer, I think we can work on some of the issues inherent in this debate. There may be some that remain unsolvable and thus would come back to you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Next up to testify, and this would be my last witness on the sign-up sheet, Tom Gallagher and Steve Smith, Oregon Newspapers.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. With me is Steve Smith of the Statesman Journal. I'll try and be very brief and, as the last witness summarized, bring you back into focus on the points here. Let me just quickly go through the history of what's happened here. The executions became legal again in Oregon. The department promulgated rules. Those rules were in effect for the first two executions. Those rules were appealed. Ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled that certain parts of those rules were invalid, and that's what is at issue here in front of you today. The department has a lot of authority to write rules in these areas. The one area that is at issue, the two areas at issue are one which has been dropped by the department, whether or not the media has to sign confidentiality disclosure agreements, which is anathema to newspaper reporters. And the second one is how much of the process of the execution do you get to view? The court found on very narrow grounds. They said that there's not statutory authority to limit participation in these two areas. Therefore, we find that those parts of the rules are invalid. The court went on to say, we declined to address certain other challenges raised by petitioners, either because those challenges are rendered moot by our decision or because it is not clear that the basis for those challenges will remain relevant after the Department of Corrections has taken steps that it finds necessary to remedy the defects in the rules identified in this opinion. In a footnote, they say, we do not reach the petitioner's constitutional arguments. So the constitutional arguments about are all ahead of us. But if I could sum this up, a very simple case, I think, here. Two very good public policies. The protection of the individuals involved in the execution process, the right to their privacy, the right to their safety and protection. I think that there are many, many ways to deal with that, and the industry would be happy to sit down with the department and do that. The second piece of that is the right of the public to know. And it is getting to be, in the 21st century, a more and more difficult right to define, because we can see very clearly the problems with these employees. We can see very clearly the risk that might be presented to them. We can see very clearly that the being the objective of negative public opinion. It's the larger right that we're going to try, and I think Steve Smith is going to try and articulate for you. We also would participate in a work group. I think I'm actually quite unhappy that, given the history of litigation on this issue, that these rules weren't, this amendment wasn't discussed with the industry. They've known of the industry's issue in this. I don't see why we can't work something out, and I think we should probably start to do that now. But that bigger issue, the right of the public to know. Mr. Smith.
Chairman Wilson, members of the committee, my name is Steve Smith. I'm the editor of the Statesman Journal and have been asked to testify on this bill on behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association and its member newspapers and editors. I'll try to be brief and not redundant. This is not about media access to an execution. This is about citizen access to the process of execution. The media, the reporters, broadcast reporters, print reporters who attend executions are representing the citizens of the state who have empowered the state to take a life, as already been mentioned, the ultimate act that the state can engage in. As representatives of the citizens, our job is to observe the process of the execution, and that is the entire process. I view that as being the process in the death chamber, to view the entire process of the execution so that we may bear witness to that process for the citizens of the state. Observing only the final piece of that process prohibits us from bearing witness to the execution, particularly to those parts of the process that are most likely to go awry. And there have been instances in other states where the process has gone awry and where the testimony, the witness of media representatives has been the only testimony to provide a true and an honest reflection of the problems that occurred. One of the previous witnesses from the Department of Corrections noted that behind that curtain, the only witnesses to the process are Department of Corrections personnel. If something should go wrong, it puts the state in the position of having to address and defend a process to which there are no independent, disinterested observers. a spot that I'm not sure the state would find itself comfortable to be in. So we're here to suggest and ask that this process, this rulemaking process, provide access to the entire process of the execution, that there be no limitation on our ability to observe and report what we see. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. I'd like to wrap this up by asking Department of Corrections to join us again, please. All right, gentlemen, if I could have you identify yourselves again for the record, please.
Chair and member of the committee, I'm Nick Romanikas, Assistant Director for the Oregon Department of Corrections, and with me is Jeff Van Valkenburg.
Thank you. I really have one question and one only that I want to satisfy before the day is through, and to your recollection, how many states in the union allow full disclosure? And let me define full disclosure and execution as, say, from the last meal forward.
From the information that we've gathered today and from the information we gathered prior to moving into execution, there are no states that allow for full disclosure, meaning from the time the inmate's removed from the cell to the time the execution is completed. And the norm has been, and from what we're, our research has, from when the time the inmate is in position and the lethal drugs are ready to be administered.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, just a clarification. In terms of the correctional officers and other staff that volunteer, if you could quickly just describe what steps the department takes to internally protect their security, because so that obviously other employees don't know who they are, et cetera. I would assume that would be part of your...
Chair, representative, other employees sometimes have knowledge who those individuals are because they're removed from their particular assignments and they have to practice and go through some drills before the event takes place. And that the practices continues in, to be more as we get closer to the date. And so they may have an identity of, or a knowledge of who those individuals are. But as far as protection, we were hoping to continue to protect our employees with the current process that we have in place that will allow for the individuals not to be viewed until the execution was actually to be carried out.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Clarification also, Mr. Romanikas, on this House Bill 2096 where it names who would be present, the superintendent of the institution, one or more physicians, et cetera, this does not list any members of the media. I would like to, I mean, this is the way the law stands currently. Does this affect what is over in the other portions of the law that designates which members of the media are allowed? There was no intent to do that, or you don't see where it would do that?
Chair Wilson, Representative Walker, this is Jeff Van Valkenburg from the Department of Justice. I'm General Counsel for the Department of Corrections. You're right. The current state of the law is that the media are not statutorily entitled to attend execution. Never have. The people did not vote that when they reinstated the death penalty. It's current quorum. The rules that the Department of Corrections has in place from the get-go in this process have always included media. Mm-hmm. My clients have advised me that for obvious reasons, of course, they would not conceive of not having the media present at an execution in the state. Mm-hmm. It's beyond comprehension.
Representative Berger.
The people of Oregon, the juries, the courts, have all given you a responsibility to carry out. You create rules. And I think the thing that bothers me is the open-endedness of those rules. For instance, as Representative Walker just pointed out, it does not say that media can be presented. There may be not any intention there, and I know you've said that maybe someone at a later time would have a different set of rules. But this is just so open-ended. And I wondered if there was some objection to the department in laying out more specifically who would be there and certainly including a more specified rules that you would have now. If that's going to be changed, it could be changed later.
Chair, Representative, I think the reason why we've decided to leave it open-ended because we don't want to continually coming back to this body and having to review this process. And that was our experience last time when we looked at it as far as limiting ourselves where we could carry the execution out. We looked at it one time about what type of drugs that were necessary to carry out the execution. So this issue has been before the legislature and other bodies to look at this statute continuously, and we wanted to hope to limit that. And that was my understanding for the open-endedness of the language.
Thank you, Representative Devlin.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make a very short statement, and I know that this is the Chair's intent in terms of, you know, there have been a lot of valid points brought up here, and I think the dilemma a lot of the committee is in is that they view a lot of the points as being valid, but they also are struck between this, the right of the public to know how this ultimate sanction is being carried out, plus the absolute necessity of protecting the identity of those inmates, of those people that are basically the agents of the government and the agents of the people ultimately carrying out this ultimate sanction. And trying to balance those two is a very difficult process. And as someone who's worked in an adult correctional facility before and had to wrestle an inmate in segregation, where it took five officers to basically get the inmate out of a cell, and two of those officers were injured, and all the other four officers were much larger than I am. I mean, I can realize some of the realities, you know, if the procedure would not proceed as calmly as sometimes perhaps is depicted in a television or a movie set. But I think the committee is struck here with some very valid points on both sides, and a lot of us would appreciate the time to think those things out and to come to conclusion.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you believe that there would be some ground to be gained by meeting and working out maybe a statute that is better than its current forms in terms of what objections the media has?
I think that, Chair, Representative Marsh, that there could be some benefit to that. We are not opposed to that.
Thank you.
Any further? All right, gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony. To the committee, I'd like to say thank you for your attention to this. This is, as Representative Devlin said, the ultimate sanction. It certainly is, and I think it bears our utmost attention. I want to thank those who've testified today for some very thoughtful comments, too. I think everybody on the committee, given the gravity of this, would like to sit on this for a few days and process what we have heard. I am interested in composing a work group on this issue in the near future, but I think we would like to just sit and think about what we've heard for a few days before we move ahead with that. But I do think a work group on this is imminent, and we'll stay tuned for the announcement on that. Anyway. All right, any further from the committee today? Nothing. We stand adjourned.